This is Democracy,
a podcast that explores the interracial, intergenerational, and intersectional
unheard voices living in the world's
most influential democracy.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. I hope everyone had a happy Thanksgiving. Today, we're going to discuss one of the most important areas of the world that receives more attention in many ways than many other areas of the world, but an area that's often not well understood, and not well understood not only for its foreign policy implications, but also for domestic policy. I'm referring to the Middle East, and we're fortunate today to have an expert on the region, one of my students, in fact, and colleagues, Emily Whalen. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
It's so nice to have you on. Emily has spent the last year living in the region, and she's writing about many of the historical and current developments in the region. She's really one of the foremost young people who understands the region, writes about the region, and puts current events in historical perspective. So we're very fortunate to have her with us this morning. Before we turn to Emily, we have Zachary's poem. Zachary, what's the title of your poem today?
The Last Time I Cried for the Middle East.
The Last Time I Cried for the Middle East. Well, let's hear it.
Sitting in a TV studio, looking out at the peaceful evening sky below, watching the pictures of Syria's slow slip into the slick of dissolution, the gassed, blown out, waiting for medicine from never, ruins ruining the ruining of forever, children and the world doesn't wait for the injured. Over the radio, the stories from Yemen flow into the living room, the starving, bomb-blasted, living in the dark, hills losing the civilized mark, people, and the world doesn't stop for the Middle East. Trying to sleep one night, losing the battle for rest, the forever fight, hoping not to have heard of the tortured soul, missing dead journalists on the floor of the consulate, the can't drive, can't eat, daring to defy, wide desert of deserted and can't remember why, a nation and the world doesn't pause for an instant. And I can't remember the last time I cried for the Middle East, the last time I cried for the bountiful bazaars spread across the sidewalks, the expanse of dunes that haunts one to the core, the heroes smashed deep into the desert swept, the hills rising sharp beyond the temperate blue seas, the temples lost among the sand, blown towards the stars on low-quality video footage. And I can't remember the last time I cried for the Middle East.
That's a very evocative poem, Zachary. Why the title? Why I can't remember the last time I cried for the Middle East?
Well, it's speaking to the fact that we've become numb to all the violence that we see in the Middle East, and it's become normal, and we forget all of the like wonderful things in the Middle East, and we just begin to expect the violence, and we don't think about the violence in our everyday lives as we do in other regions.
Right. Emily, Zachary's poem presumes that we all know what this concept of the Middle East refers to. Where does the term come from, and why do we use it?
Well, thank you, Zach, for that poem, and thanks, Jeremy, for having me on. I'm really delighted to be here. In terms of the term Middle East, that is, you know, actually, I'm not sure of the provenance of the term itself, but it does, there's a lot in that phrase, right? A lot of times my friends and I will jokingly refer to America as the Middle West. Because, you know, when you designate it something east, you're also implicitly designating where the center is and what is in the center. And so
right.
it's east of Europe, it's east of North America. And implicitly in the term Middle East is, of course, the idea of the West as well. So, you know, it's so widely used at this point that it would be sort of clumsy not to use it. But it, technically, it refers to the Arabian Peninsula, the Levant, and then also sort of Western Asia. And now it has also come to refer to Northern Africa as well. So it's a broad swath of land, and it's sort of it's not confined to one particular continent. So it's representative of the region as a place of exchange, as a place of interaction, and as a place of blending, which it has historically served, you know, throughout most of human history.
Right. Why do we use this term for such a diverse place? I mean, we have 4 to 5 religions more. We have so many different languages and cultures. Why this term for such a diverse place?
Some of it is sort of convenience. People often, you need a term to be able to refer to a group of countries and a group of regions that share significant cultural elements and share significant historical elements. So the Arab conquest in the 6th century, that sort of covers it, what we refer to as Middle East sort of covers the heartland of what was the Arab conquest. The reason I think that we have such a generic term for it is precisely, as you said, you know, there's so many different religions, there's so many different languages, there's so many distinct cultures. I spent a few years living in Jordan before I was living in Lebanon, and, you know, those are two countries that are very close to each other but have incredibly different cultures. Jordan is more of a Bedouin culture, more of a desert culture. Lebanon has a much more urban culture. It's much more sort of the heart of the Levant. So, precisely because the Middle East doesn't fit easily into any of the categories that we have invented for people in this sort of post-war, post-World War II era, we kind of give it a generic term that doesn't really capture all of its complexities, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's actually very helpful. And why, with this generic term, why has the region come in the eyes of many Americans to be associated with particular kinds of behavior and particular experiences and not others? Zachary's poem refers to a sort of recurring list of violence mm-hmm. and tragedy, which is part of the history, but of course not the entire history of the region.
Sure. There are a few reasons for this. One is an historical reason. I'm going to sort of skip over the colonial era because that's a whole other
right.
podcast. But as the world begins to sort of organize itself, and the United States and Western Europe begin to engineer this program of organizing people by ethnic or religious designation into homogenous nation states, sort of starting in 1919, let's say, in earnest, we run up against a problem in the Middle East, which is that there is really very little ethnic, religious, or even linguistic homogeneity. It is a place of exchanges, as I said, of blending, of diversity, and it's a place where there's been a very ecumenical approach to culture. Even during the Ottoman Empire, there was no sort of concerted program for converting people to Islam. Mm. You could be, any religion that you really wanted to be, you faced different laws, and you were in different sort of political positions because of that. But there was a much more, as I said, ecumenical approach to people's identities. So with the advent of nationalism and the creation of the nation state, you run up into a lot of problems in the Middle East because you start to get people sort of competing over which identity is going to be the primary identity, is going to be the organizing principle. And then that sort of runs up against the waves created by the colonial empires and imperialism. So there's a lot of overlapping currents here that are really hard to parse out and very difficult to kind of quantify. But the end result has been that there's been a lot of conflict and a lot of war in the Middle East.
And in a sense, the term leads us to, as outsiders, leads us to emphasize that element of it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I would say is that there's another component of this, which is less historical and much more contemporary. And it can be difficult to remember how contemporary it is, but pretty much since 9/11, the relationship of the United States to the Middle East has been immediately politicized, intensely politicized. Mm-hmm. So the coverage of the region has tended to bias violence and to bias towards, negative stories and things like that because of the way in which the Middle East sort of broke into our 24-hour news cycle mm-hmm. and our media culture mm-hmm. so dramatically with the attacks on 9/11.
And do you see this period since 9/11 as a period of not simply conflict within the region, but conflict in some sense spurred and encouraged by outside actors?
Yeah. So this is always a point of conversation. There's an Arabic term, "anlamana." It means the plot. And so there's a strong discourse that has existed ever since the colonial era, but it's definitely accelerated since 9/11. That all the region's problems are due to the intervention of outsiders. and to a certain degree, that is true. But I would say that a lot of the outsiders have had local actors who have been allies.
Right.
So it's much less, you know, the CIA coming in and screwing things up for the Middle East, and it's much more sort of the local partners, people who are, you know, Lebanese or Jordanian or Saudi or any number of these different nationalities, who sort of ally with external powers in order to increase their advantage at home, and in doing so, create a situation that is beneficial to certain classes of people, certain political and economic elites, but that in general is very difficult and worse for the most of the people in the region.
Right. So you have internal and external dynamics overlapping,
yeah,
and at some moments exploiting one another.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
So a couple of countries that I think draw an inordinate amount of attention, at least in the Western media, most mm-hmm. recently, of course, Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, why has the United States found itself for so long so closely allied with what in many ways is one of the most dictatorial, undemocratic regimes in the region?
That's a great question. And I have to say, this is actually one of the more encouraging developments I've noticed in the past, even just a few months, is that people are beginning to draw a more critical lens to the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia. So the short answer is that for a long time, the United States didn't really have a Saudi Arabia policy and didn't really prioritize having a relationship with Saudi Arabia. So they were happy to defer to people who were very interested in Saudi Arabia, namely American oil companies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for the first few decades of the relationship between the United States and the Middle East, and in particular in the Gulf, those relationships were entirely in the hands of American oil companies. I'm thinking of Aramco in particular, but you know, there are a variety of different
sure.
actors there. So when you have the nationalization of the oil companies in Saudi Arabia and the turnover to Saudi control of those oil companies, there is a little bit of a shift, but for the most part, the people who are directing U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia have at one point been beneficiaries of this system of oil extraction and selling.
So you would refer, for example, to the Bush family that
yes.
made money in oil, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so there is, you know, I always hesitate to kind of talk about this because you don't want to promote conspiracy theories or things like that, but there is a demonstrable history of people who have been heavily involved in oil being the people who drive our policy towards Saudi Arabia. And so some of this is just bureaucratic inertia at this point. We are allies with Saudi Arabia because we've been allies with Saudi Arabia, and to change the gears of sort of the ship of state away from that would be incredibly difficult.
But how do we reconcile that, Emily, with repeated, I think sincere, American mm-hmm. pronouncements about supporting democratization in the region?
Yeah, it's difficult because we haven't really supported democratization. We've supported democratization in the sense that we support elections and the sort of what I would call formal democracy, the sort of external indicators, the measurable, achievable, I'm doing air quotes, but you can't see that because we're on a podcast. the measurable and achievable sort of things that we associate with democracy, but we haven't supported substantive democracy because in a lot of, especially in Saudi Arabia, you know, there's a long history of the American oil companies helping the House of Saud to repress labor riots and to marginalize particularly the Shia population in the eastern provinces. So we haven't actually supported substantive democracy, by which I mean people having a meaningful say in their own governance at every level, and that political figures will be accountable to the populations that they govern. That is not something the United States has unfortunately ever really supported in the region, because there has been in that an implicit threat to the economic interests of particularly powerful companies, and now the United States government in terms of our arms sales to the region.
So when we look today at the Saudi assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, who was a dissident figure, an immigrant to the United States, journalist who covered the region, is this something unusual? Is it unusual that the Saudis killed a dissident figure outside of their country? And is it unusual that the United States, at least the American president, is accepting this behavior?
I would say it is unusual in one particular regard, which is that in its latency, in its flagrance. I think of Mohammed bin Salman, who is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia and the mastermind of this assassination, he is not the cause of the problems. He is sort of the result. He's a symptom of a longer problem that we've had towards the region. So there has been a long tradition in Saudi and in other countries with which we are allied of repressing political dissent. That is something that is as true in Morocco as it is in Jordan. Unfortunately, that is now one of the defining features of the region. Even Lebanon and Tunisia, which are two places where you have a degree of press freedom that you do not have anywhere else, there are still, you know, things you can't really talk about, things you can't publish. So this is entirely in keeping, frankly, with the trend of the Saudi government in particular, but of many other governments in the region.
What should the United States do? What would you, as an expert on the region, what would you like to see the United States do?
Yeah, I think that there is an encouraging trend here, which is that people are starting to kind of question the status quo. There's more of a critical lens, and not just in people who are among people who are studying the region, but among people who are just sort of generally interested in U.S. foreign policy. For a long time, the status quo of the U.S. Middle East relationship was sort of sacrosanct, and now people are beginning to question it more often. I had someone at a dinner a few weeks ago ask me, "Well, why are we allied with Saudi Arabia and not Iran?" Because they're both authoritarian theocracies, they're both repressive, and it seems like you know, six of one, a half dozen of the other. And that question I was very, very happy to answer that question, simply because that is the right kind of reframing. For a long time, particularly after 9/11, there was a lot of focus on, well, are the Sunni better than the Shia? You know, which of these sort of various sects should we ally ourselves with? But the point is that we shouldn't be concerned about the kind of granular level details. It doesn't matter what sect or clan or particular religion we ally ourselves with in the region. It matters if we ally ourselves with freedom and with, as I said, substantive democracy versus authoritarianism and theocracy. So that is encouraging. I see more people making that fine distinction. And I think we need to keep doing that. And I think it's important that American citizens, even if they don't think they have a stake in the Middle East and are not particularly interested in the region, need to kind of make that leap themselves, because what happens, you know, in the Middle East, it affects what happens at home, because I would say we're in our own struggle here in the United States against creeping forces of authoritarianism and theocracy.
Mm-hmm. And focusing on a substantive democracy, as you put it, makes a lot of sense. But of course, it gets very complicated when we bring in Israel, which we haven't talked about yet. So
I was studiously avoiding that.
I know you were, but so many would argue, many Americans would argue, that our substantive defense of democracy is a defense of a strong Israel, and an Israel playing a more often aggressive role in the region.
Sure.
Is that how do you reconcile that with an argument for more attention to democratization in countries like Saudi Arabia?
So I think it's important to make a few distinctions here. One is, Israel is not the Likud party, and Israel is not Benjamin Netanyahu. So there is, I believe, a space for a democratic nation named Israel, if you so desire.
But many would say, Emily, that the Likud is a democratic. It's a manifestation of democracy. The immigrants from Russia and elsewhere who came to Israel in the last 20 to 30 years have shifted the political winds and produced a political leadership that looks different from what we were accustomed to with Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin and others.
Well, I would say that that's definitely an argument, but if we're kind of, if you look at Israel in its entirety, and I mean it sort of even just from a demographic perspective, it's very difficult to argue that it is a functioning democracy because there are significant populations of people who live within the boundaries of the state of Israel who do not have any political rights whatsoever. And I'm referring, of course, to the Palestinians who live in the occupied territories. And even the Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza, you know, I have never been to Gaza. I've been to the West Bank a few times. Just going there, it's very sort of this kind of international pretense that we maintain that they have any substantive form of sovereignty is very frustrating. Just the architecture of occupation penetrates very far into the West Bank, very far into, and obviously in Gaza, it's an open-air prison. So I think that in order for Israel to become a truly democratic state, they would need to award Palestinians full political rights. I know that it's a very difficult topic for a lot of people, and it's very emotional. I think it's hard to argue that people who live in a country should not be awarded full political rights in that country simply on the basis of their ethnicity or their religion. And this is precisely what I think the Likud has pushed Israel farther away from that reality. I think there are a lot of people who live in Israel. There are a lot of Palestinians even who are happy to be Israelis as long as they have political rights.
It's true, but many would argue, of course, that there's a recurring terrorist threat, that there are violent actors within those areas. These are difficult topics to reconcile. Why do we have such difficulty with these issues, Emily? I mean, I think you're doing a valiant effort to explain these very big questions. And it's interesting to hear you struggling to bring in so many different perspectives, and you're doing it so well. Why is it so hard to talk about these issues? It seems harder in the Middle East than almost anywhere else.
You know, it's so funny that you say that, because I was just thinking it's so much harder to talk about these things in the United States than it is in the Middle East. One of the things I love about the region is that, you know, everybody is very... you don't have the luxury of not being political. So everybody's very politically engaged, in terms of actual political activity. Unfortunately, a lot of them have had their rights curbed, but in terms of talking about politics, you talk about politics all the time. And because you talk about it all the time, there's less concern that you're going to offend somebody or someone's going to misinterpret what you're saying. You have a more constant dialogue about it. And I think that's a big part of the problem here in the United States is that there's almost a taboo against talking about particular topics in the Middle East, Israel in particular. As I indicated, it's really difficult to discuss Israel in the United States because there are people feel very strongly about it,
right,
and for good reason. But people feel strongly about it, and then simultaneously, there is not a culture where you can actually talk about this stuff. You can't, you know, there's almost a silencing that
right.
goes on of public discourse. And there's a political reason behind that. If people don't feel that they can talk about things or make mistakes or try out new ideas, then there's more likely to protect the status quo.
Right, right. So maybe, Emily, that's a place for us to turn to our last question, which is really what the show has been all about. How can we as citizens who don't have the expertise and the in-region experience you have, how can we connect our hopes and aspirations for democracy to the way we talk about and think about the region? How can we move our dialogue forward in your terms in the United States? How are you, through your research and writing and activism, helping us to do that?
I think there are a couple sort of things I always try to keep in mind when I'm consuming information about the region. One is not to confuse governments with people. Often what we see of the Middle East, particularly in the main media channels, is just at the surface level. We see the interaction of governments. We see statements made by political and economic elites. We shouldn't forget that there are people who live in the region who are just trying to live their lives. You know, they just want to wake up in the morning and go to their job and then come home to their families. And that's the vast majority of people in the region. Life is very, very normal for a lot of people, even people who are living in ostensible war zones. You know, in Aleppo, there've been Russian strikes recently. Half of the city is decimated, but the other half of the city remained pretty much untouched. And, you know, people are kind of, unfortunately, you know, living pretty normally. Not unfortunately, but there's a sense of, well, this is not ideal, but this is our chance at normalcy, right, so we're going to take it. Right. You know, and that, I think remembering that there are people like that in the region, and again, that's most people in the region, is very important. You know, something you've talked about on your podcast, and that you and I have spoken about, is that we're facing a lot of challenges to democracy and to justice here in the United States as well. So I think, you know, in the coming decades, we will need to build, you know, broad solidarity across national and regional boundaries. And the more that we can look at people who live in other countries and other regions and say, that person is not so different from me, that's going to be very, very important moving forward. So I think we, you know, opening yourself to having conversations that are difficult with people, asking questions. I always try to make sure that the first three things that I say in a conversation with someone about the Middle East are questions. Even in conversations where, you know, I've had more experience in the region than other people, I have something to learn from someone who has no exposure to the region. Right. I'm interested to know what people think. And just kind of getting away from this idea that you have to, you know, spend decades of your life studying Arabic or live in the Middle East to have an opinion about the Middle East. I think if you come to it sort of with some humility and some curiosity, it's perfectly fine for you to form opinions about the region. I think it's, you know, a good idea to have strong opinions loosely held.
I like that, strong opinions loosely held. I love your emphasis upon the willingness to question and learn, even from a distance, rather than the almost flawed and seductive effort to impose one's views, to learn the views of others rather than impose one's views is an important discipline.
I think it's going to be important for the Middle East and for the United States, and I think for a lot of the world in the coming years, to be willing to think creatively about substantive democracy, how we achieve substantive democracy, and don't fall victim to this kind of attachment to forms of democracy. So thinking about, you know, maybe more participatory government, you know, associative government, things, ways that we can engage politically, even here at home, that focus on what the important functions of government are, not on controlling particular territorial, territorial designations.
Yeah. So, Zachary, are these the kinds of issues that motivate young people like yourself when you think about the Middle East? Do you and your friends care about democracy in the Middle East?
I think we do, but I do think there's still a lot of people of my age who just think that the Middle East is just violence and that's it, and they can't think beyond that, and that's...
And how can we get beyond that, Zachary?
I think we just need better education, because often what we were taught about the Middle East is more about the conflict and less about the people.
Right,
and
right,
culture.
Right. Well, I think that's a perfect note to close on. Emily has given us such a tour de horizon, such a beautiful and deep understanding of the very complex dynamics in the region, and allowed us to understand the human element of it. And I think that connects to Zachary's poem and Zachary's final point here on how humanizing our understanding of a region is essential for a discussion of democracy. You cannot talk talk about democracy in any substantive form unless you actually think about the people who live within these systems that we're talking about, systems that we're often intervening in one way or another. Thank you for an enlightening conversation today. Thank you for joining us on This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harrison Lemke, and you can find his music at harrisonlemke.com.
Subscribe and stay tuned for a new episode every Thursday featuring new perspectives on democracy.